This has been Bridget Willis for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service. By Maya Angelou. This has been Bridget Willis for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the coronavirus update, followed by USA Today at 2.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 75 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update from the Recording Library of West Texas for Wednesday, February 3rd, 2021. I'm Michael. Coming up today, we have a special program. This show is going to run a full hour today. We have a special podcast that we're going to run that was produced by the Texas Tribune. This podcast features the guest, Dr. Peter Hotez from the Baylor College of Medicine, and he discusses things regarding the Texas legislature about mask mandates, vaccine availability, reopening schools and businesses, and the trajectory of the pandemic. This will run 46 minutes, so we will bring that to you after just a few brief updates. We'll first look at the numbers. Ector County numbers from the Texas Health and Human Services Commission, confirmed cases 7,101, probable cases 6,622, fatalities 295, estimated active cases 1,628, estimated recovered 11,800. From Midland County, confirmed cases 15,687, fatalities 215, estimated active cases 2,776, recovered 12,696 estimated. For the state, from the Texas Tribune, average new cases decreased by 1,873 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On February 2nd, 18,951 new confirmed cases and 3,133 new probable cases were reported. Hospitalizations decreased by 1,849 patients compared with a week ago. As of February 2nd, 11,002 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths decreased by 20 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On February 2nd, 331 new deaths were reported. Now we're going to read just a few articles for you as we have to make room for the podcast we're going to bring you in just a few minutes. You will be able to get a COVID-19 vaccine at two major pharmacies in some states starting next week, from CNN's Samira Said. CVS and Walgreens will begin vaccinations as part of the federal retail pharmacy program starting next week, the pharmacy chains announced on Tuesday. CVS said the federal government will provide around 250,000 doses directly to the pharmacy chain, and it will administer those doses in 11 states starting February 11th. Walgreens said it will get around 170,000 doses, which it will administer in 15 jurisdictions starting February 12th. Here's where they will be available. At CVS, the 11 states include Texas. At Walgreens, its 15 jurisdictions include cities and states. Texas is not among them, but New Mexico Walgreens will have the vaccine. Eligibility requirements in each jurisdiction still apply for both pharmacies. The Biden administration announced Tuesday it will begin direct shipments of coronavirus vaccines to retail pharmacies starting February 11th to about 6,500 stores that will receive a total of 1 million doses before eventually expanding. Cold chain storage for vaccines is a really tricky process, says Walgreens' chief medical officer. from CNN's Andrea Diaz. The cold chain storage for coronavirus vaccines is a really tricky process, Walgreens chief medical officer, Dr. Kevin Ban, said on Tuesday. The remarks came after Ohio health officials reported that vaccines given by Walgreens in five of Ohio's long-term care facilities had not been stored under the proper cold storage conditions. It would seem that our systems failed. Now we're trying to figure out exactly what happened there so that we can protect it from happening again in the future, Ban told CNN. The cold chain takes a lot of, literally, it takes cryogenic gloves. And so those things will happen. We just need to be transparent and we need to fix them, Ban said. According to Ban, none of the patients experienced any adverse side effects, and after getting in touch with the manufacturers, they learned the patients will need to be revaccinated. Too many vaccines. Ban added that Walgreens was left with excess vaccines due to very high vaccine hesitancy and the lower than expected occupancy in long-term care facilities. We found ourselves in a situation where we had more vaccine than we needed. The last thing we would ever do is hold it. And so immediately what we did was get in touch with the states to make sure that we were compliant with their wishes, Ban said. Walgreens does not determine who gets vaccinated. We're the last mile of this. We're the ones who actually distribute and administer it, but only based on state eligibility. And now we have three articles related to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine could limit the spread of coronavirus, researchers say, from CNN's Michael Nettleman and Jessica Ferger. The Oxford AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine may reduce coronavirus transmission rather than simply reducing the severity of the disease, according to researchers. The vaccine showed 66.7% efficacy against symptomatic disease starting 2 weeks after the second shot, according to a preprint posted Tuesday by researchers at the University of Oxford. The study did not measure transmission directly, but researchers collected regular nasal swabs from participants and found that the rate of positive PCR tests fell by half after two doses of the vaccine. If the vaccine were simply making infections more mild, PCR positivity would not change, the authors argued. While transmission studies per se were not included in the analysis, swabs were obtained from volunteers every week in the UK study, regardless of symptoms, to allow assessment of the overall impact of the vaccine on risk of infection, and thus a surrogate for potential onward transmission, the authors wrote. Coronavirus vaccine trials have primarily looked at prevention of symptomatic cases of COVID-19. Previously, there has been little other public data suggesting that the vaccines could prevent people from passing the infection to others. Oxford AstraZeneca study supports spacing out doses and estimates good efficacy after one shot, from CNN's Michael Nettleman. The Oxford AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine showed 66.7% efficacy against symptomatic disease starting 2 weeks after the second shot, according to a preprint posted Tuesday by the researchers of the University of Oxford. However, the latest analysis also suggests the vaccine may offer substantial protection after a single shot. The study estimates 76 efficacy up to 3 months following one dose. This is based on a subset of 88 symptomatic infections split unevenly between the vaccine and placebo groups between 22 and 90 days after vaccination. The study also found relatively stable levels of antibodies during this time frame, with minimal waning by day 90. Furthermore, the author suggests there could be higher efficacy with more spaced out doses. Among adults 18 to 55, vaccine efficacy appeared to rise when the time between the shots was spaced out from less than 6 weeks to more than 12. However, more information is needed to know how statistically different that finding is. Taken together, the findings may bolster the UK's decision to recommend spacing out doses up to 12 weeks apart, according to a statement from the chief investigator of the Oxford vaccine trial, Andrew Pollard. Some context. AstraZeneca announced last month it had completed enrollment in its Phase 3 trial in the United States, which will serve as the primary basis for the company's eventual application to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The vaccine has already been authorized in a number of countries, such as the U.K. and India, but authorization may not come in the U.S. until late March at the earliest, according to Operation Warp Speed's Monsef Slaoui. French health authority recommends AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine for people under 65. From CNN's Pierre Barron. The French National Authority for Health on Tuesday recommended that France approve AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine. However, the agency recommend restricting its use for people under 65. The data currently available in people aged 65 and over are limited by a small sample size and do not allow conclusions to be drawn on the safety and efficacy of the vaccine in this population, the French health authority wrote in their recommendation summary. For people 65 and older, the drug regulator recommended giving a different type of COVID-19 vaccine, called a messenger RNA vaccine. This is the type of vaccine made by Pfizer and Moderna. A spokesperson for the health authority said the French government will be making the final decision on who gets the vaccine and the exact guidelines for its distribution. More people in the U.S. have received one dose of the vaccine than have been infected with COVID-19, CDC says. From CNN's Virginia Langmaid. The number of people who have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine in the United States is now more than the number of COVID-19 cases in the U.S. over the course of the entire pandemic, according to data from Johns Hopkins University and from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. On Tuesday, the CDC reported 26,440,836 people have received one or more doses of a COVID-19 vaccine. Johns Hopkins has reported 26,384,829 cumulative COVID-19 cases in the U.S. as of now. According to the CDC, 6,064,792 people have received both doses of a vaccine and are fully vaccinated. This is about 1.84% of the United States. Younger adults are the biggest spreaders of coronavirus in U.S., study suggests. From CNN's Maggie Fox. The biggest spreaders of the coronavirus in the U.S. are adults aged 20 to 49, and efforts to control the spread, including vaccination, should focus on that age group, researchers reported Tuesday. Children and older adults accounted for very little spread, the researchers said, suggesting that reopening schools may not contribute to spread if transmission is controlled among younger adults, they said. They found that adults aged 20 to 49 accounted for about 72.2% of COVID-19 infections after schools reopened in October. Less than 5% of infections came from children and less than 10% from teenagers. And it might be adults aged 35 to 49 who are the biggest factor in driving the pandemic. This group accounted for 41% of new transmissions through mid-August, compared to 35% for adults aged 20 to 34. Large UK study confirms COVID-19 antibodies last at least 6 months, from CNN's Zahira Rahim. A large British study looking at coronavirus infections in real life confirms what lab experiments have shown. Most people keep some antibodies to the virus for at least 6 months after recovery. The study also indicates 8.8% of the UK population had been infected with coronavirus by December, but almost twice as many blacks, 16.3%, had evidence of a previous infection. The study from UK Biobank, a biomedical database and research group, measured levels of previous infection in various population groups across the UK from the end of May to the beginning of December. It showed 99% of participants who had previously tested positive for COVID-19 retained antibodies for 3 months after being infected, and 88% had them for 6 months. Although we cannot be certain how this relates to immunity, the results suggest that people may be protected against subsequent infection for at least 6 months following natural infection. More prolonged follow-up will allow us to determine how long such protection is likely to last, Naomi Allen, UK Biobank chief scientist, told a news briefing Tuesday. Antibodies were found in a greater proportion of younger people compared to older participants. The researchers said 13.5% of participants under 30 had detectable antibodies, while only 6.7% of those over 70 did, and 16.3% of black volunteers in the study had antibodies to the virus, compared to 8.5% of white participants and 7.5% of participants of Chinese ethnicity. Allen said the team does not know whether the antibodies could provide protection against new variants of the coronavirus. Rory Collins, head of the Newfield Department of Population Health at the University of Oxford, said Tuesday that people who had previously been infected should still take care and obey social distancing guidelines. "We can't be sure that antibodies provide complete protection," Collins said, adding that scientists still did not know if people who had been previously infected could still carry and transmit the virus. And once again, we are going to go to our podcast produced by the Texas Tribune. Again, this podcast features the guest, Dr. Peter Hotez from the Baylor College of Medicine. He's a virologist, and Evan Smith will talk to Dr. Hotez about mask mandates, vaccine availability, reopening schools and businesses, and the trajectory of the pandemic. This podcast runs 46 minutes, 44 seconds. I'll return after the podcast to wrap up our program.
I'm Evan Smith of the Texas Tribune, and this is Point of Order, a podcast about the ins and outs, the ups and downs, the people and politics and traditions of the 87th Texas Legislature. This week, the state of COVID. The first coronavirus case in Texas was, if you can believe it, not quite 11 months ago. How can that be? The public health emergency feels like it's been with us for so much longer, especially when you consider the toll it's taken here in that short time. More than 2 million confirmed cases and nearly 300,000 additional probable cases. Hospitals and particularly ICUs filled to the gills. And more than 36,000 deaths, not to mention the impact on employment and the economy, public and higher ed, and nearly every aspect of our lives and livelihoods. Across the U.S., the number of confirmed cases tops 26 million, with more than 440,000 deaths. And there's no end in sight, not even with the availability to certain people in certain groups of several different vaccines and more on the way. It looks to be quite a while, perhaps 6 months or longer, before mass vaccination is possible and a return to something approaching normal is on the table. How did we get here to this extraordinary and unprecedented moment in history, and where are we going? With state leaders set to grapple with the consequences of the outbreak in the 2021 session, I wanted to ask those basic questions of this week's guest, Dr. Peter Hotez, the leading virologist in Texas. Dr. Hotez is the founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, where he is also co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development. Throughout the pandemic, you've not been able to turn on the news or read an op-ed page or doom scroll through social media without seeing his name or conjuring the image of him we've come to know. Tucked into his office, always in a bow tie, often in a lab coat, a mix of calmly reassuring and bracingly candid. He's our version of Dr. Anthony Fauci, ubiquitous, expert, and apolitical, to the extent that anything about the coronavirus is apolitical these days, and with the understanding that being apolitical is not the same as not having a point of view. Dr. Hotez definitely has one. He's been a crusader for years, for instance, against the flat earthers who reject science and recoil at vaccines, a fight he always believed was his responsibility to wage, but never more than now. Indeed, his next book, soon to be published, is titled Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science. in the middle of his typical tornado of a schedule, with the cable TV bookers breathing down his neck, Dr. Hotez kindly talked to me on the morning of Monday, February 1st, day 21 of the 140. Point of Order is supported by Texas Biomed, a nonprofit infectious disease research institute whose sole mission is advancing health worldwide. Visit txbiomed.org to learn more. And by the Texas Medical Association, working to improve the health of all Texans. Get the latest COVID-19 information at texmed.org/coronavirus. And the Hobby School of Public Affairs. Why are one-third of Texans saying they won't get the COVID vaccine? Go to uh.edu/hobby for answers. And Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Texas. Proud to support this conversation because public dialogue and civic engagement are important and play a role in improving the health of Texans. If I told you a year ago we'd be where we are today, would you have believed it?
I tell you, I never. Well, you know, as of a year ago, we actually knew about COVID-19. We knew the emergence of the virus. I think the shocker is how, as a nation, we let this get so profoundly out of hand and couldn't organize ourselves to launch a national control program.
Was that something that you could have predicted, though? I guess if you go back a year ago, understanding that the disease was going to take the path that it took, would you have imagined, though, I guess, that we would have allowed this, if it was more in our control than not, that we would have allowed this to get to this point?
Well, you know, I think there are two major surprises, or three major surprises. One was the fact that, you know, when this first emerged, we thought it was going to be like the other pandemic coronaviruses, SARS and MERS, which were primarily respiratory viruses, number one. And number two, if you got sick, if you got the infection, you knew it. You were sick. You were not out and about in bars and concerts. You were in bed or in the hospital because it was such a severe illness. There was not that asymptomatic shedding. So that's what's been so deadly about this virus. Not just the fact that it's a killer, but the fact that there's this whole group running around with asymptomatic infection. That Janus face of the virus has been what's been so problematic. And then the way our federal government responded with denial and downplaying the severity of the pandemic and calling it a hoax, and then refusing to launch a national strategy. So the two big failures of the administration, the White House, were one, insisting the states be in the lead and the federal government would provide backup support. That was a non-starter from the beginning. That was never going to work because the states don't have the epidemiologic tools to know how to do this. And second, then when the disinformation campaign came around, that was really awful. And that's when I really had to call it out and disentangle the science from the politics. So to me, the three big pieces of this were the asymptomatic transmission and then the two major White House actions or inactions.
And of the latter two, one of them was a sin of omission, not really doing anything in terms of taking the lead, but the disinformation campaign was something actually active. It was a sin of commission, right? That was something that a decision was made somewhere along the way to put bad or wrong information out.
Yeah, no, it was deliberate, and I was, in some ways, I think I was the first to see it because I've had that experience. You know, Evan, we've spoken over the years about my going up against the anti-vaccine movement, which is so powerful right in Texas, and I like to say I can smell a anti-science disinformation campaign a mile away because of my experience. My experiences here, and so I was the first to really pick it up and label it and call it out, and I think that was really important. I hope it's saved some lives.
Yeah, well, I want to come back to the anti-vaccine stuff here in a little bit, but let me ask you, staying on the subject generally, the number of cases and the number of deaths nationally, you know, we've almost become desensitized to seeing these numbers every single day as they tick up and up and up. Are you surprised by the magnitude of this? I mean, the number of cases and the number of deaths is really something that in our lifetimes we've never seen and never could have imagined.
Yeah, that's right. Not only the deaths, but who is dying and the way we've allowed our most vulnerable populations to bear the brunt of those deaths, and how we've allowed this virus to rip through low-income neighborhoods unimpeded. Also, the fact that, hey, there's more to come, and we'll talk about that. We're in a
right.
bit of a downturn now, but there's another big piece about to hit us.
Yeah, well, I'm almost afraid to ask you about that. When you look at Texas compared to the nation, again, Texas is obviously disproportionately large. We have a very large population. When you look at our deaths and our cases relative to the national case count and death count, do you look at Texas and think we're pretty much where we ought to be, or we're better off than where we should be, or worse than we should be?
I think we're worse than we should be. There's nothing to be proud about in our track record of COVID-19. I mean, we've more or less led the country in cases and deaths, being at the top one or two.
Right, but is that a factor, Doctor, of the population being so large, or is it not just that?
I think it's a bit more. If you look at the pattern of the cases and deaths, also it's kind of interesting. Because people compare us a lot to California, and now the numbers are kind of equivalent. And California, of course, is larger, but let's assume for essentially they're about the same. What happened was we were doing much, much worse than California for most of 2020, and then.
Right.
And California looked like it had been spared the brunt of the epidemic, and then something happened over the last month, January and the last 2 weeks of December, that things just really accelerated. So, you know, California wasn't even much of a problem in many ways, even though it had been one of the first places where it emerged. Texas was so much worse. Now California's caught up a bit for reasons that I don't quite understand.
So you don't know if it's that California did something wrong in the last little while, or if just things accelerated there, or if we did something right. I mean, I'm trying to understand how did we change places in that way?
Well, it could be because of a variant that emerged out of California that, you know, we don't know. Everything moves so fast, right?
We don't know.
Right. So that may be a possibility. But, you know, I mean, just look at our state, more than 2 million cases. And remember, that's an underestimate.
That's the ones we know about for sure. That's the confirmed cases.
That's exactly right, because we've learned that we underestimate it by around 4 to 1. So we may be close to 8 to 10 million Texans who are infected, and, you know, a population of roughly
30 million.
30 million, you know, you're looking at a fourth or a third of the state.
Population.
And
right.
then the deaths, which are just so awful.
And also probably Dr. Hotez undercounted, right? Undercounted as well. If the cases are undercounted, the deaths are undercounted.
Probably. So we're approaching 40,000 deaths. And, just to give you the comparison to that, the number of Texans who sacrificed their lives in World War II is half of that. The number of Texans who fought in the Civil War and lost their lives was between 3,000 and 20,000. So way less than half were, you know, the horrible Galveston flood of 1900, that was 8,000. So we're looking at what could be argued to be the worst catastrophe to ever hit the state of Texas.
And again, we've become a little desensitized to it, right? Because the slow ticking up of these numbers, we ought to be more horrified, mortified. We ought to be more alarmed by what we've done and haven't done, right? But those numbers don't seem to be sinking in for a lot of people.
Yeah, unless, you know, maybe it's because it was amortized over the course of a year. People right. have gotten desensitized to it or seeing it on the news.
It's a frog in boiling water, right?
Yeah, and, you know, but the truth is now we're at the point, and this is where things become very destabilizing, where everyone in the state of Texas will have known someone who's been severely ill, hospitalized, or even have lost their lives from COVID-19.
Right.
And that, to me, that's when it morphs from a public health threat to a homeland security threat. And then that's where I'm worried we're headed.
You know, Doctor, the big conversation, which in some respects is irrelevant because the time has already passed us and the consequences of the consequences, is the degree to which this was and is preventable. And the debate seems to take place along three different paths. One is this is entirely about government action or lack of action. A second is that this is entirely about personal responsibility. And the third is kind of the this is God's wrath argument, that there was nothing that anybody, government or any of us individually, could have done to fix this. Which path are you on, or is it a combination of those three?
Well, I'm trying to strike a balanced view here. First of all, this is a really hard virus to fight for that simple fact that you've got half the people infected walking around being asymptomatic. I don't care who's in charge. This is going to be a challenge, and no one's going to look good. All right? I think that's important to put that down. The thing that I would have liked to have seen happen more in Texas, as it did in some other places, is when our emergency rooms and ICUs started to get overwhelmed, that's when we had to take more aggressive government action, because we learned pretty early on in this pandemic, back a year ago now, back in February, March, and April, from Southern Europe and Spain and Italy and then New York City, is that the deaths go up when hospitals get overwhelmed. And now we're seeing this in the UK as well. And when ICU staff, and it's not just the beds, because as one of my bosses, Paul Klotman, always says, you can always convert a regular bed into an ICU bed. What you can't make up in a hurry is a trained nursing staff and trained hospital staff. And that's when things get overwhelming very quickly, and that's when people start to lose their lives. And so the lesson there is, as you see surges, especially in some of the bigger metropolitan areas, like we've seen in El Paso and Lubbock this year, or down in South Texas, that's the time when you do have to start shutting things down for temporary reasons. And too often, that's not what we've been willing to do. So if I had to say one thing I would have liked to have seen differently, it's that. But no matter who was in charge, you were going to see significant loss of lives. Could we have cut that close to 40,000 number in half or less? I think yes. I think that's possible. Right now, you know, everything's changed with the release of the vaccines, and that's got to be the new focus now.
Yep.
Getting the people of Texas vaccinated as quickly as we can ahead of the new variants coming.
So let's walk up to that question of the vaccine and the variants. Let me ask you, though, to comment on the basics as the first step. Basic stuff, Dr. Hotez, that it seems like we shouldn't have to be talking about 11 months into this. Do you have any doubt in your mind that masks work?
No, masks work, and we need masks, and social distancing works. They're crude approaches, but they seem to have a big impact.
So the sort of fashionable thing now is to say, I'm going to wear two masks. I'm going to do this double. Do you think we need to be doing that, or is one mask sufficient?
Before I was vaccinated, and even now I wore two masks. I think it's just an extra layer of protection, because you don't know if there's a tear in the mask or
yep.
quality of the mask you have. But look, you know, I still, you know, I live in, my wife and youngest daughter and I live together in the Montrose section of Houston. And, you know, I'll take a walk with Ann early in the morning or at night, and especially walking along all the cafes on Westheimer Avenue, you know, no one's got masks, or very few people have masks. So it's still, even a single mask still has not, you know, really entered our culture yet.
Do you have any sympathy at all for the argument that mask mandates are infringe upon our liberty or our choices as people? I mean, the argument that some make is, if I want to be stupid enough to make this choice, it's my choice to make, and I don't want the government or anybody else telling me that I need to be putting a mask on because I'm not persuaded. I mean, look, I was watching a conversation play out last night on social media. The former state senator, Connie Burton, from the Fort Worth area, who was in conversation with Donna Howard, the Democratic representative from Austin. Connie Burton posted a video of a doctor, a guy in a lab coat at least, who was saying, I don't necessarily believe that masks work. And we're actually still 11 months in having this debate back and forth about whether masks work. And it's conducted entirely along the lines of, don't infringe upon my liberty. Any sympathy for that at all?
Sympathy, sort of, but in the end, condemnation. I love living in Texas. We've been here a decade. It's been the most productive time of my life. I think some of the most interesting people I've ever met live in the state of Texas.
Yep.
And we've had this discussion, Evan. I'm of the believer that some of the most intellectually curious people I've ever met live right here in the state of Texas. It's mm-hmm. it's a state that flourishes in the arts and literature and the sciences. But there's a dark side to our state as well, and that dark part of that dark side is manifested through this health freedom, medical freedom movement that really accelerated here in Texas around 2014, 2015. And when, the leadership of Texas, ever since I've known it, has always been very pragmatic, very not too ideological, focus on solving real life problems. But somehow this concept of medical freedom, health freedom has taken hold, and it aligned itself to political extremism on the far right and linked itself to elements of that here in Texas. And it first manifested as parents withholding vaccinations from their kids. And this is when you saw Texans for Vaccine Choice Political Action Committee form in 2015 under this banner of health freedom, medical freedom.
Right.
And that's that devastating consequences. Now we have 72,000 kids denied access to vaccinations because of it. Measles outbreaks, and we'll see more of that. And that's what we know about. We don't know anything about the 350,000 homeschooled kids we have in the state of Texas. So we easily have over 100,000 kids not getting their vaccines. And that's when I really took this on, because here I am, a vaccine scientist, pediatrician, and a parent of an adult daughter with autism, because they have claims that vaccines cause autism. And if I don't fight that, who will? So been fighting that fight. And Texas Tribune, by the way, has been really good in helping, get that word out. I deeply appreciate it. But then what happened, Evan, was in 2020 that anti-vaccine movement morphed again under the banner of health freedom, medical freedom, and began protesting masks and social distancing. This became a full-on anti-science movement. And then you had, all of the major thought leaders, and I'll put that word thought in quotations, in around health freedom, medical freedom, either were already in Texas or moved to Texas, especially in the Austin area. So you had Alex Jones and then other leaders of the anti-vaccine movement come to Austin. And so this has become sort of the headquarters of health freedom and medical freedom. And I'm saying, no, I mean, this is costing lives.
Right. And you're saying that not just as a Texan or as a parent, but you're saying it as a medical professional.
Yeah.
You're bringing the receipts on this.
Yeah. I mean, all year I've been about saving lives, and we should talk a little bit about that, because, when I had to disentangle the disinformation campaign from the White House, the accusations were I was just against Trump. And I said, look, I had nothing to do with that. And in fact, I've been going out of my way to go on conservative news outlets to talk to everybody. I've been going on Newsmax and Fox News and the Daily Caller, and I've been going on the African American radio stations. And
it's not about politics, right?
And, by the way, I've been on MSNBC and CNN lately saying there are things that the Biden administration should be doing that they're not. And that's also interesting. That's right. By many as a betrayal, that how could I, after all we've been through, to now criticize the Biden administration.
Yeah.
Really criticizing, saying, look, there are things that need to be done to save lives. And hopefully at the end of all of this, I'll come out okay, that someone who was really fixed on one thing, saying that, all lives have value and all lives are worth saving, and I don't care what your ideology is, I'm going to try to save your life.
Let me ask you again, sir, a couple more practical things, and then I want to get into the vaccine discussion. Would you be sending your kids to school today if you had kids the age of public school students, if you were a parent of young kids?
I feel better now than I did in the fall, and I'll feel better next fall than I do now, and the reason is because the thing I worry about sending kids to school is not so much the kids. I worry about the teachers, the staff, the bus drivers who we saw this in New York City. So many lost their lives in the early days of COVID because those are the ones who are getting sick. Then the kids are bringing it home. So there's no question kids are transmitting this virus. And there is some level of morbidity, but the real thing that worries me is all of the adults who are getting sick. And if we can get enough people vaccinated, I would feel better about going to school. I think the other surprise in this, you know, I was last summer, I was advising teachers about and superintendents and principals about how to set up the plexiglass and how to do the social distancing. But I always had to end those conversations. You know, I have to tell you my honest feeling, you know, you guys are doing everything humanly possible to stack the deck in your favor and to try to get through the school year. And I think if you were in part of the country that had low transmission, we will get away with it, we'll be okay. But when we had that screaming high level of transmission over the summer, you remember in Texas in the early fall,
right?
I was really worried. It turns out things did go better than I would have predicted. So I think those measures that the teachers took really, and I helped a little bit with, really made a difference.
But now,
you know, I hate to say this, with the new variants coming, all bets are off. We haven't seen how the new variants really
right.
behave in a school setting, so I'm holding my breath yet again.
Does that extend to restaurants and then beyond restaurants to bars? You know, there's been some discussion, at least where I live in Austin, that the hospitalizations have been down. Maybe some of the capacity rules can be relaxed on the basis of slightly better numbers. Are you confident that, I mean, because again, you talked about the reopening of Texas earlier and the potential for this to be posed as a choice between the public health on the one hand and the economy on the other, as if those things are either or, as opposed to sequenced in a proper way, or both and. Right.
Yeah, the only, you know, I recognize that life has to go on, and people, not everyone can afford losing their livelihood. Not everyone could live, you know, like many of us do, doing things through Skype and Zoom. But the focus had to be when we were seeing those big surges on the ICUs. And if we're not seeing that right now, I think, you know, this may be a window period when we can have restaurants open. I don't know about the bars. The bars are always going to be problematic until everybody's vaccinated, just because everyone is such close contact and
right.
loudly over music and doing things that people do in bars. But you know, the restaurants and other businesses, I think, but with an asterisk, and the asterisk is we're seeing a decline right now. So nationally, we're down about 30% from new cases a day, from 250,000 new cases a day, which really means a million new cases a day, to 150,000, which is still pretty high. If, you know, I remember hearing about Dr. Fauci's apocalyptic prediction of 100,000 new cases a day, and now we're down to 150, and we're feeling good about that.
Right. Yeah. Well, the definition of the apocalypse has definitely changed over time.
And so if there's ever a time to start opening things, now's the time, but it's the variants.
It's the variants. So I read David Leonhardt in the Times this morning, New York Times this morning, saying, and we're talking on Monday the 1st, that, you know, people want to say that the vaccine is not effective enough and that the news is not all good. His argument is, no, the vaccine news is good, that the point of this is not to eliminate the coronavirus completely, but to turn this from a pandemic into a normal virus. The issue isn't no infections. It's a material a change in hospitalizations, deaths, and long-term complications. He's presenting the vaccine news up to this point, generally speaking, as positive. You agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I think the vaccines look, you know, giving a pretty robust level of protection, especially when we use it in two doses. And we have a recombinant protein vaccine that we hope is meets that.
Right.
The issue is this. If we can vaccinate the U.S. population, including the population of Texas, to the point where we can halt virus transmission, and our estimates indicate about 75-80% of the population, it's a pretty high bar.
Yep.
Potentially we can get ahead of the variants and prevent the variants from taking us over.
That's the argument, right? That we have to, we're in a race. You've said this. I think you're actually quoted in the Tribune today saying this, that we're in a race between vaccinating versus the emergence of these variants. And so the question is, if we get out ahead of it, then we're in a good place.
And unfortunately, that shifted the timeline, because I was saying late last year and the beginning of this year. Therefore, we have to, if we can get fully vaccinated by the fall, I think we'll be okay and life will get gradually better. Now, you know, we have to call an audible again, using the football metaphor, going up to the line of scrimmage and seeing, uh-oh, things don't look right. We're going to have to make a quick change.
Right.
And quick change is getting the population vaccinated.
Right.
By say June 1, and that's where I tend to depart from what the Biden people are saying. That from now, they're still kind of sticking to the older timelines, and I'm worried about that. I think this really we need to accelerate things.
Accelerate this, yeah.
And it's a really high bar. I mean, if you look at, you know, again, 30 million Texans, if we want to get to 3/4, 24 million Texans, say over 6 months. You know, you do the math, right? That's 4 million a month. That's 8 million doses a month. The numbers, you know, we're talking about 20,000-30,000 Texans. No, 200,000-300,000 Texans every day, and we're just not close to that.
We're not on the pace of this. So let me ask you about the Biden stuff, because you've mentioned a couple times that you don't see the pace of this going the way that it needs to. I saw Dr. Michael Osterholm, who, you know, like you, is an infectious disease expert. He's at the University of Minnesota. He's been a transition advisor for the Biden administration, on Meet the Press yesterday. And I believe you actually were tweeting a bit about the Osterholm comments yesterday, too. He said that he thought the deadlier UK variant of COVID is going to become the dominant strain in the U.S. And what Dr. Osterholm said was the surge that's likely to occur with the new variant from England is going to happen in the next 6 to 14 weeks. And he actually said, sounds a little bit like what you're saying, that the U.S. needs to move faster to get the first doses of the vaccine in as many people as possible to fend off a bigger crisis from the variants. He compared the consequences of not doing this to a Category 5 hurricane making landfall. So it sounds like, at least from his perspective, he's with you that we need to do this faster.
Yeah, we differ a little bit. By the way, for full disclosure, Mike and I are on regular Zoom calls every week. So we're talking with a bunch of other colleagues. So we're talking every week. And I think we're both in agreement that this could be a very apocalyptic in terms of this new variant, the way it's coming, the way it's surging, and the way it will surge across the country. And by the way, we don't even know how widespread it is, because we've so underperformed in terms of genomic testing. That's one of the other ways our national response has come up small. But it's clear that this is going to happen. I think the only way where I differ a little bit from what Mike is saying is he's of the opinion to not give second doses of the mRNA vaccines to everyone, just stick them with a single dose. I'm not impressed enough with the performance of that single dose to make that call. Instead, I've been saying, look, don't screw around with the mRNA vaccine. It's a good vaccine in those two doses. But now let's accelerate bringing the others on board.
The others meaning the other vaccines.
That's correct. So the European Medicine Agency, the EMA, just approved the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine for release. We're sitting on, I believe, tens of millions of doses on that. We're ready to go. We should also release that. We need to move on the J&J vaccine, the Novavax vaccine, and then our vaccine. You know, we're not getting any help coming from BARDA or the U.S. government about how we bring our vaccine in from India. And I think if we could bring on those four other vaccines in our heart, we can make a huge difference. Rather than playing card tricks with the mRNA vaccines.
What do you think about the categories that we've established for access to the vaccine, the prioritizing of people in, you know, 1A, 1B, and so on? Do you think that we should be getting more people outside those categories vaccinated? Are we doing this properly? The prioritizing.
No, I understand the 1A, the healthcare providers and the nursing homes. That made sense. From then on, I think the guidelines are too fussy. And if we're really going to accelerate vaccinations at the scale that I'm suggesting, as well as Mike is suggesting, those rules just become a barrier. They're too confusing. And, you know, we spend too much energy pointing fingers at each other about who ordered the turkey club and who ordered the salad niçoise. We don't have time for that. Yeah. And I think we've got to do a mind adjustment here and a reframing and say, look, we're in crisis mode. We have to open up the hubs, whether it's community health centers like the Bayou Center that we opened here in Houston, or, you know, some of the big venues, some of the sports stadiums.
Yep.
We need to do this high throughput, and anybody who wants to get a vaccine should have to get a vaccine. And I don't even see, quite honestly, the logic of all of the computer sign up and password protected codes. Forget about it. We're not, you know, this is,
make it easier.
Just make it, I mean, make it dumb. Make it so that somebody wakes up in the morning and say, hey, you know, maybe I really should get vaccinated. It's just like voting, right? It's like when that week of voting, you know.
Well, don't compare how easy Texas makes it to vote to how easy you want it to get vaccinated. You want to kill all of us, right? Look, the president said last week that he intended to purchase 200 million more doses of the vaccine. That was said by the president and celebrated by the administration as this massive advance. Is that ambitious enough?
Well, but, you know, then he said by the fall. And I said, what? I said,
it's not magnitude, it's timetable.
Yeah. And then I said on, I think it was MSNBC, I think it was with Nicole Wallace, I said, you know, that's like, you know, waiting for the glaciers to come back down from Quebec. And then, of course, only on Twitter, right, I get all these tweets saying, hey, Dr. Hotez, you know, Quebec doesn't have glaciers.
Right. You're not a glacier expert. Stay in your lane. I get that. Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you got a vaccine.
Yes, I did.
How long ago?
I was one of the first to get vaccinated, so it was made available to Texas Children's Hospital healthcare workers. So in December, I got my first dose, and I was fully vaccinated by the beginning of January.
Which vaccine did you get?
I got the Pfizer vaccine. But I would have taken any of them, quite honestly. I mean,
right. You have confidence. The point is that you have confidence in these vaccines enough that you were not going to choose between one or another.
Right. And I have confidence in our FDA. They've made, you know, they really rebounded.
Right.
I mean, Stephen Hahn is from Texas.
Well, right. And Stephen Hahn got an enormous amount of crap in that last period of the administration, didn't he?
I think it was, you know, he walked in there and he walked into a maelstrom and had some initial stumbles, as anyone would have walking into that situation. But he really rebounded well.
Yeah.
And, I was really proud of the way he conducted himself and the way he stabilized the FDA. In the end, he did a terrific job, and to the point where I wouldn't have minded seeing stay on in the Biden administration. But
let's go back to your vaccine, the vaccine that you got. Did you have any ill effects, side effects, anything, consequences of the vaccine?
Yeah, in the second dose, about 24 hours afterwards, I had shaking chills, maybe some fever. And that's okay. That's how you know the immune system is working. So
is it wrong to talk about that? I mean, there was a criticism for a while of media reports of people who took the vaccine, one vaccine or another, and, well, you know, this was the consequence of it. And it had the effect, some thought, of dissuading people from doing it. It made people more nervous. Well, if there's going to be these effects of it, I'm not sure if I want to do it. Is it right or wrong to talk about it? It sounds like you're saying it maybe is right to talk about it, but it's an indication that it's working.
Yeah, you've got to talk to the American people, and this has been the problem with Operation Warp Speed. It was a good problems. It was it's a development program that somehow led the American people to believe it was more than that. It was actually going to bring in the Army and the National Guard to start vaccinating, which that didn't happen. It was sort of dumped off on the states. But the other was, there was never a communication strategy. It was left to the pharma CEOs, who were very poor communicators.
Yeah,
or the anti-vaccine people. So there really was no communication strategy. And, you know, I did what I could, you know, going on the cable news networks. But
you're one guy.
One guy. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm a medical school professor. I'm not working for the U.S. government. So
yeah.
There wasn't that accountability there either. So
right.
I think we need to, that has to be fixed as well.
So on the anti-vaccine question, which you've brought up a couple times, I mean, after all, it is your brand to talk about this, understandably. This weekend, I noticed that there was a mass vaccination site at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles that you probably saw in the news, was shut down Saturday afternoon briefly because there were anti-vaccine protesters gathered at the entrance. I mean, this is kind of the place we are, where even if we're attempting to give people access to the vaccine, people who say, I don't want the vaccine, don't are not willing to simply say, I'm going to opt out myself, but they're trying to actively prevent other people from being able to opt in.
Yeah, this has become now a full-on national anti-science movement, and unfortunately, it actually started. I've been looking into the history more and more, and it really started in Orange County, but it mostly amplified here in Texas, especially in the Austin area. So, you know, this is a homegrown movement.
Yeah.
But now there are other elements to this, and it's getting real. So now in the last year, there's been now links to QAnon. That worries me. And now you're seeing the Russian government weigh in. So the Russian government has now put in this systematized program of what we're calling weaponized health communication, where they're flooding our internet with fake anti-vaccine messages. And so this has become a very complicated
ecosystem.
And now what was, you know, kind of a small fringe movement coming out of political extremism out of Texas is now a full-on empire, a confederacy that extends now into Western European capitals and the Russians. And nobody's really standing up to it or combating it. I mean, I've been writing about it and calling it out. I had a major paper out in PLOS Biology last week to kind of go into some further details. But we're going to have to do something about it.
Here are the consequences of it. So we're talking today on Monday the 1st. By the time people hear this tomorrow morning the 2nd, there'll be a new University of Houston survey out. We've had an opportunity to preview it that says that nearly a third of Texans who responded to their survey either definitely or probably won't get vaccinated. So we're talking about, I mean, you called out earlier the need for herd, what I guess is popularly known as herd immunity, right? Where some high percentage of people are vaccinated, and as a consequence of that, we feel like we can begin to return to normal life. So you've got a third, nearly a third, 32%, who say definitely or probably won't get vaccinated. You and I both know, Dr. Hotez, 25% of the population in Texas is under 18. Most of those won't get a vaccine. How do you get to the numbers if there's that much resistance, and if the demographics set up the way they do, can we really achieve that goal?
Yeah, I mean, this is a big worry. You know, I think as more and more Texans get vaccinated and people see their friends and colleagues and coworkers get vaccinated, I think some of that will melt away, but not completely. We did a survey, a similar type of survey, and I did this. I was part of it, but it was led by my colleagues at Texas A&M at the School of Public Health, and they're social scientists, led by a guy named Tim Callahan. Our study found that we identified two groups that are extremely vaccine hesitant. And what was interesting about it was they were the same two groups that independently the Kaiser Family Foundation did a survey 2 weeks before found. And so our number one vaccine hesitant group that we found were Trump voters, and what the Kaiser Family Foundation found called Republicans. And then number two were the African-American community, and they found the same thing. So, I mean, talk about two diametrically opposed groups, you know, sort of meeting around vaccine hesitancy for different reasons. So what's the basis of that? Well, the Trump voters / Republicans, I think, is bred out of that whole health freedom, medical freedom movement that we're conversation with. That's all coming out of there. The African-American community, you know, I don't know fully. You know, some are saying, calling it historic and structural racism, you know, in the legacy of the Tuskegee experimentation that ended in the early 70s. No doubt that's true. But the other piece that I point out that not many are aware of is that the anti-vaccine group specifically targeted the African-American communities in 2019. They held a series of high-profile rallies in Harlem called the Harlem Vaccine Forum, and even had one at the Riverside Church on the Upper West Side in New York, which is one of the iconic churches in the Civil Rights Movement, Reverend Sloan Kaufman. So I think there's some deliberate targeting there going on. But so that's what I'm doing now. I'm going on African-American radio stations.
Right.
And I just did one with D.C. Cofield, who's one of the pastors of one of the big churches here in the Third Ward. And then I'm doing Newsmax and going on all those places. The interesting thing about the Newsmax interview was it really came down to the anchor's concern, and I'm assuming that's reflective of maybe the conservative community, about mandates. Again, getting back to this health freedom.
Right, this, it's the political aspects of it.
Worse on us. And I said, look, I don't know why we're going there. It's not that we don't even have enough vaccines to vaccinate the people who want to get vaccinated. Nobody's talking about mandates at this point.
Well, the numbers don't allow you to do mandates. I mean, just go back, though, for a second. We're going to wrap here in a minute or two. I want to go back, though, to the African-American community in Texas, which, according to an AP study this weekend, is behind as a percentage of its population the degree to which the vaccines have been out. I believe the study in the AP said that in Texas, the black population is about 13%, but only about 7%, a little bit more than 7% of the vaccinations have been in the black community. So the black community is not being vaccinated relative to its population size. I saw this morning a suggestion that part of the problem here is that we're making, and you